Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, Ebbe. I am the aforementioned Sal along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. We appreciate you taking time out of your busy afternoon to come join us for another live edition of Midrats, unless you're getting the podcast, then of course it's not live for you. But for that esteemed cohort that is with us live, if you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, you'll find the chat room. We'll be there with you during the course of the show, and if there's an observation you'd like to share or a question that you would hope that at some point during the next hour my co-host and I will ask our guest, you can go ahead and put it right in there. And we will do our best to fold that into the conversation. And if you got to take care of some stuff and you missed part of the show, if you haven't already, just go ahead and go over to iTunes, Spreaker, or whatever podcast catcher you use and subscribe to Midrats. It's free. And that way, Midrats will be ready for you when your time allows. Now let's go ahead and pop into our show today. When you, during the pre-show, we were talking about the importance of having a good map or a good chart for your nautical types, and I think that's especially helpful today. I'm not saying you need to freeze the show and go find your nearest chart, but at least in your mind, it's helpful if you have a memory of the waters and we're looking at, and I have a little one for you there on the show page for you to ponder, because in the vast reaches of the Pacific Oceans, the islands of Melanesia, Micronesia, Polynesia, they're all along critical sea lines of communication for the economic powerhouses on to the south, to the north, to the west, to the east. And during the Age of Discovery on, as international commerce expanded and expanded, their importance continues to rise to the top of any power that's interested in either projecting power or ensuring the free flow of goods and services across the global commons at sea. And our guest today to discuss this and related topics is Alexander B. Gray. And as a starting point for our conversations will be the issues he raises in two recent articles. The first one you can find over at The Diplomat, how U.S. can protect the sovereignty of the smallest Pacific islands, and also at The Hill from earlier this year, why a crisis in the Pacific Islands matters for Washington and Beijing. Alex is a senior fellow in the National Security Affairs at the American Foreign Policy Council and served as director for Oceania and Indo-Pacific Security at the White House National Security Council from 2018 to 2090. Actually, not 2019. Alex, you're not time traveling, but you are on Midrats. Welcome aboard.
Thanks so much for having me. Really happy to be here.
Appreciate you coming on. And, yeah, that's always one of the fun things about doing a live record is if you step on a rake, everybody gets to see. And hopefully we won't have too many of those, at least not from you today. If so, it just adds to the flavor of it all. But I touched on it a little bit in the intro, but I wanted to give you an opportunity for the listeners that when we're talking about the small islands of the Pacific in China, the one item that regularly breaks above the background noise when people are talking about the Pacific and islands, they're thinking of the South China Sea, some of the conflict with China and the Philippines, Vietnam, or a little further north, Taiwan and Japan, but we're talking about a different part of the ocean here. During the course of the next hour, as we talk about the small Pacific islands, how would you define those in the context of your articles and what we're going to talk about today?
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I think it's always useful to have some geographic context as we think about what these islands mean for the United States, for China, and for the competition that the two great powers are in right now. I would look at it, there are a couple ways to kind of decide what constitutes the Pacific Islands. I've heard a lot of people refer to the second island chain to differentiate between the first island chain stretching from Japan down into Southeast Asia. I think second island chain is a decent starting point because it includes a lot of the Melanesian islands. It includes some of Micronesia. But it's broader than that because we have to think all the way over to islands that are closer to Hawaii, which is the third island chain. You've got to stretch all the way over to Polynesia, including French Polynesia. You've got to stretch to Kiribati, which is almost 1.5 million square miles of sea area, so which really stretches from the Central Pacific all the way over to near the Eastern Pacific. So really, I think the most succinct way to sum up what we're talking about here is the term Oceania, and there are 14 sovereign countries in Oceania, including Australia and New Zealand. There are another maybe 10 or so territories and dependencies of other countries. The subregions, which you alluded to in your intro, are also very helpful in breaking down what we're talking about here. So you've got Melanesia, which is really Papua New Guinea, Vanuatu, and the Solomon Islands. You've got Micronesia, which, depending on how you define it, I think the generally accepted way of looking at Micronesia is the Federated States of Micronesia, the Republic of the Marshall Islands, Palau, Nauru, and parts of Kiribati. And I think Polynesia, which is Samoa, Tonga, and some of the dependencies to include French Polynesia and some of the New Zealand realm states, Niue and Tokelau. So I think that's a paints a decent picture of the expanse of which what we're talking about here, really stretching all the way from Palau, which is near about a 4-hour flight from Japan, all the way to Kiribati, which is within a little over 1,000 miles from Hawaii. So that's the expanse that I think we're talking about when we refer to the Pacific Island states or the Pacific Islands.
Yeah, if you look at a map and the international dateline is the 180th meridian, and then we're talking about a range from that to about 135th meridian. So it's a huge part of the world, and it's interesting to me as you look at it, how much of it the United States, the French, and other countries have claims on it. I mean, the United States, the Northern Marianas, the Baker and Howland Islands, the Hawaiian Islands, Wake Island. We own a big and all the associated exclusive economic zones around those things, including what the French have, and then the countries that are now independent, like Papua New Guinea and the Solomons. I guess. I mean, that is a big part of the world. Why do we worry about the Chinese dealing with these entities and the influence they're trying to have on the Micronesia and the Polynesian area?
Yeah, it's a good question, and it's a question that I got a lot when I was in government because there were plenty of people, good, well-intentioned people who were interested in the China competition, but who couldn't understand why we were spending scarce time and scarce resources on islands they'd never heard of, or if they'd heard of them, they'd heard of them in the context of a World War II battle. You know, they didn't really have the appreciation for how do these islands fit into modern day U.S.-China grand strategy. And I think the answer is these islands have been a part of U.S. strategy since our founding, and it's a little known fact just how much the security of these islands and they aren't controlled by a hostile outside power it impacted our history and our grand strategy. John Quincy Adams, in his 1825 State of the Union address, actually spoke about the Pacific Islands, about how critical it was for the U.S. flag to fly over the Pacific Islands from the standpoint of commerce and control of the sea routes from what was then beginning to be the settlement of the Northwest Territories, now Oregon and Washington State, and the trade in furs and the trade in beginning to have trade from the West Coast of the United States to East Asia and to the China market. And that same rationale, to some extent, has continued for almost 200 years. You look at kind of how we've thought about the islands, and it's been relatively constant since the time of John Quincy Adams. William Seward, who's President Lincoln's Secretary of State, made a large effort to try and acquire additional territories in the Pacific because he was also envisioning a period after the Civil War where the United States would be interested in additional commerce in the Far East and would need, at the time he was thinking, the very Mahanian view of coaling stations and bases, but ultimately, as time progressed, so you referred to the possessions. We still have 9 possessions in the Pacific, many of which in the 1920s and 30s became stops on Pan American Airways and became landing fields for the Navy and for civilian use as well. So these, I've heard them actually. John Quincy Adams referred to them as stepping stones to the Far East. And those stepping stones have had really the same economic and strategic importance to American interests over the course of this period. During the First World War, the Germans had acquired a significant number of these islands over the course of the 1880s, 1890s. They were taken over by Japan at the end of the war as League of Nations mandates. The Japanese then went and fortified the islands, particularly the what's now Micronesia down into Melanesia, and of course led to the horrific fighting in World War II when the United States liberated those islands. Several of the islands, particularly in Micronesia, were converted into United Nations trust territories, which the U.S. administered on behalf of the UN for most of the late 20th century. And then beginning in about the 1970s, 1980s, most of the Pacific Island countries were granted independence, either in some sort of compact, like the United States has with 3 of the islands in the Pacific, which hopefully we'll talk about more. There have been other arrangements as well. Vanuatu was ultimately administered by a joint British-French condominium until it received its independence. So really the overall U.S. approach has been, going back to the time of the German colonization, has been we have to maintain the ability to safely move commerce through these islands, through these critical sea lines of communication into East Asia for reasons of commerce and trade. We also have to, from a military standpoint, as we saw in the Second World War, we have to be able to move significant numbers of troops and supplies from Hawaii and from the West Coast through these islands to East Asia. And that continues to be the case today. It's applicable for a Korea Peninsula scenario. It's applicable for a Taiwan scenario. And so that's why these islands continue to be more important, as important as ever, if not more important. And what we're seeing as the Chinese begin to grapple with the strategic implications of these islands for themselves, what we're seeing is Washington is beginning to grapple with, for the first time since the Cold War, we're actually facing a competitor who's interested in these islands, who has the resources to compete there, and who is making it not guaranteed that the U.S. will have access and freedom of movement through those strategically critical islands.
And you're right, there is a growing concern, and as usual, we're being reactionary and playing catch-up a bit. But earlier this month, there was a panel held by the U.S. Naval War College. I believe also the Japanese War College was involved. And one of the presenters there, Cleo Pascal, sent me a link to it because she actually stole one of my diagrams because I really love great circle routes, especially like this. But the panel was on, and the panel actually was from last month, the 10th or the 12th of May. It was titled Maritime Security Issues Concerning Small Island States. And it's bringing up a lot of the issues that you've done in your articles, and it is going above the background noise, partially because, and you have to respect the Chinese for seeing the board on the big sense, because one thing I brought out is when you run the Great Circle route from Long Beach, San Diego, and you run it to Australia, that one of the islands, Canton, is all of 25 miles from there. And I wanted to open the door here to talk about treaties and agreements, because one thing the Chinese are using, because that island is under the Tar Treaty, where no other nation is allowed to set up any military bases. And of course, the Chinese are like, oh, this is just a civilian interest. And we all know how that story goes from there. And I believe what you were referring to before that, and I hope we can dive into what the leader of Palau has done, has been the compacts of free association. So there's a whole bunch of compacts and agreements and treaties out there. I wonder if you could just touch on the most important ones, and which ones do you think are good and strong, and which do you think are weak and need to be updated?
Yeah, that's the key question, really, for how do we go forward in the region and protect our interests and protect our friends. So the compact, we have three compacts of free association, or COFAs. Those are with the Federated States of Micronesia, FSM, Palau, and the Marshall Islands. The COFAs are really a unique instrument in the history of bilateral relationships between sovereign countries. Because remember, the three, that we call them the freely associated states because they're the signatories to the COFAs. The three freely associated states are sovereign countries. They aren't dependencies. They aren't territories or possessions. They are as sovereign as any other country, but they've chosen to enter into agreements with the United States that the United States provides for their defense. The United States is granted unlimited access to their airspace, to their land, and to their territorial waters for defense and military purposes. And the United States provides visa-free entry to the United States for their citizens, as well as social services that are really much more like something we would provide to a U.S. territory than to a sovereign country. We pay for their health care. We pay for we shouldn't say we pay entirely for their health care. We've set up some mechanisms whereby the U.S. taxpayer contributes to the health care of people in Palau, Marshall Islands, and Micronesia. We assist with infrastructure. It's a really robust and different relationship than anything else out there. And it's those three compacts have served in a really important purpose going back to the Cold War. They first came into effect between the late 70s and the early 90s. And the compacts allow us the access, the unrestricted access, and the right of denial. We're allowed to deny access, and we usually never have to do it. The relationship with all three is so robust that there's usually no reason to have to exercise this right. But theoretically, under the compacts, we can deny any other country the use, the military use of the territory of the three compact states. It's given the strategic location of all three, and I would say right now, particularly Palau, given its location about 4 hours flying time from Japan, it's particularly vital that we have these arrangements. We do have some other treaties in the region. You mentioned the Treaty of Tarawa. The problem with those is, of course, it's a treaty just like any other treaty where the signatory could choose to disregard it at their whim. The compacts, because it involves a whole of society integration. I mean, the compacts because have really been one of the most successful bilateral agreements that I can think of in modern times, because it's taken three very different countries with unique histories, and it's integrated them into the United States in so many different ways. You know, they actually serve, the citizens of the three freely associated states serve in the U.S. military in some of the highest percentages. If they were a state, all three of them would serve at a higher percentage than any U.S. state relative to population. There have been about 9 Micronesians killed in Iraq and Afghanistan. I mean, they are incredibly integrated and dedicated to the relationship with the United States, which is very different from a document like the Treaty of Tarawa that really hasn't had to be enforced and hasn't been integrated across the political and the cultural spectrum. So I think what you're looking at is the compacts of a free association are the gold standard for how the United States can operate in the Pacific. And they're related, frankly, to a unique set of circumstances where you had, as I mentioned earlier, you had the three freely associated states that had been taken from the Japanese after World War II. The United Nations had placed them in trust territory. The United States administered them for several decades and then granted them independence. And at the end of the independence period, entered into these compacts as a way to continue our involvement and to assist in the development and the growth of those countries as sovereign entities. So it's unique, but I think, as I wrote in my article, it can also serve as a really important test case for a slightly modified version that we can use in other parts of the Pacific. I've talked specifically about Kiribati, Tuvalu, and Nauru as being areas where the United States could explore a similar mechanism. And I think Kiribati comes to mind particularly, and I'll just say one thing about Kiribati. You know, it's got about 120,000 people. It's one of the largest exclusive economic zones in the world, about 1.4 million square miles. It's 30 atolls spread across over 1 million square miles of water. It's in, you know, it's in two different sides of the dateline. It extends across different regions of the Pacific. Kiribati is an extremely, it's a state that's extremely vulnerable in a lot of senses. It's vulnerable to outside influence because it's small, because it's geographically dispersed. It's vulnerable economically because the islands themselves, their topography and terrain don't lend themselves to a lot of sustainable agriculture and sustainable economic investment. And it's vulnerable from an environmental standpoint. It's vulnerable to weather events. It's vulnerable to climate changes. It's vulnerable to all sorts of different outside impacts. And I think that's what makes Kiribati a particularly interesting potential partner for the United States as someone who could look at a modified version of a compact of free association where we could agree to help Kiribati with some of its economic needs while at the same time gaining access as well as the denial right that we enjoy with the other freely associated states, which would have a security value for the United States, it would have a security value for Kiribati, and would also address some of Kiribati's internal challenges. So I think that might be a model, as I've written about, to explore with some of the other smaller, more vulnerable Pacific Island states.
Well, China's extended, I mean, I think about 2 years ago, I had a piece about China and the Solomons, where they'd apparently got themselves a lease of an island, Tulagi, I think it was, or Tulagi in the Solomons, and they've also influenced was it Nauru, one of the countries there, they've influenced them to change their mind about recognizing Taiwan and can you kind of discuss that, how China is influencing these, what they're using to influence these islands to bend China's way, especially like in the Solomons?
Yeah, so I was involved in some of the issues surrounding the Solomons, and you know there are two issues where we've seen China particularly focused on these islands, and they're interconnected. One is the Taiwan question. So at one point in time, Taiwan had a significant number of diplomatic allies, countries that recognized Taiwan rather than China in the Pacific Islands. Even 2 years ago, they had six countries who recognized them. They had Kiribati, they had Tuvalu, they had Nauru, they had the Solomon Islands, they had the Marshall Islands, and they had Palau. In the last 2 years, Kiribati has switched recognition to China, and the Solomon Islands have switched recognition to China. So what we're seeing is a persistent campaign by China to target countries who have that recognition and to use a variety of different inducements, carrots and sticks, to change recognition. And this isn't something that's unique to the Pacific. This has happened in South America, Central America, Africa. It's a well-known stated goal of the Chinese Communist Party to ensure that Taiwan's diplomatic recognition is reduced essentially to zero. That being said, the manner in which they've gone about doing that has been primarily economic, and it's been primarily done through the One Belt, One Road initiatives. And what the Chinese have done in the Pacific, which are generally underdeveloped countries, generally countries where there's a lot of, as I mentioned, focusing specifically on Kiribati, there's a lot of environmental challenge, there's a lot of isolated islands, oftentimes infrastructure that's not fully developed, islands that are separated from each other by vast distances, sometimes by tens of thousands of miles of ocean. So what the Chinese have done is they have come into places like the Solomons, they've come into places like Micronesia, places like Samoa, and they've decided to invest large amounts of money on very high-end infrastructure projects that are very popular with the leaders of the country, initially sometimes very popular with the population, but oftentimes turn into what we call white elephants. You know, I can point you to a couple of examples. They built a very large project in Vanuatu. It was a meeting hall for the legislature, and ultimately it was so big and so unwieldy that it couldn't even be used by the legislature because it was built, but it wasn't provided with all the relevant services that were needed to run it, the electricity grid and all the attendant needs to operate a building of that size. And they've done that across the Pacific. They go out of their way to build very dramatic displays of friendship, and then either the quality of the infrastructure is poor, or, and this is the one that is most concerning for long-term investment and the long-term stability of the Pacific, is the Chinese force the countries to take out significant amounts of debt in order to have these large projects, indebting the countries to China, thereby exerting over time political leverage over these small developing states. And it's a particularly pernicious activity in the Pacific where, to begin with, there's not a large private economy to ultimately even be able to service the debt. So we're dealing with countries, Samoa is a good example. We're seeing now playing out there, there was recently an election where the longtime leader, Prime Minister Tuilapa, was voted out of office. His party was voted out because the opposition party was able to mobilize popular discontent with how much of the country's GDP is being spent on debt to China for some infrastructure projects. And there's really beginning to be, to some extent, a backlash across the Pacific with the amount of Chinese influence and the amount of economic and political influence that the Chinese are exerting through these One Belt, One Road infrastructure projects. So that brings us, I think, to what is the longer term, most concerning aspect of all of this, which is how quickly and how easy it is for a One Belt, One Road infrastructure project, a port, an airfield, a variety of different infrastructure projects, to be converted into at best a dual use facility and at worst an out and out military installation that the Chinese, the PLA or the PLAN, could take advantage of. And we've seen concerns raised about this in Papua New Guinea at Manus Island. We've seen concerns raised about it in Vanuatu. We've seen concerns raised about it in the Solomons, now in Kiribati. And it just seems as if the Chinese continue, as One Belt, One Road continues to expand across the Pacific, there's this, and Chinese political and economic influence follows it, there is a continual flurry of rumors and innuendo that a Chinese military tail is in the offing. And I think that's what the United States, at least when I was in government, that was one of the things that we were focused on, making sure that we understood and the islands understood that this was a component. We had to think about the entirety of the relationship that China was trying to establish with the countries of the Pacific, and that it was multidimensional, and that if we looked at it from just one lens, we might risk losing the totality of what Beijing's ambitions were in the region.
Yeah, it's amazing. Geography is one of those things that does not change. Time, distance may adjust for the speed you're moving, but the planet isn't moving much. And the importance of those islands, a combination of distraction and entitlement, it's amazing what we have forgotten right on the edge of living memory. I was listening over the course of this weekend as I drove all over the place. Dan Carlin has a great podcast series on histories. He's a journalist by training, but he tells stories like a good historian. And he was at the part of World War II. It's about a five-hour podcast talking about what the island campaign in the Pacific cost, not just in time, material, but also morale in the U.S., how much, you know, those islands bought the Japanese time. They're important. And what the Chinese are doing using that political leverage you talk about, but also the personal leverage, always goes back to leaders and what type of governments you have and the leaders you have. And I wanted to take a second to have you talk about what I found a fascinating character. When you look at a country like Palau, a little under $20,000 population, when you look at even great large countries who, lack of a better phrase, kowtow or whitewash or talk nice about the Chinese, their president, and my apologies if I mispronounce his first name, Surigao Whips Jr., I do a little extended quote from your article on him, and this is from the president of Palau, quote, "This is about securing our borders, and other countries that don't respect other countries' borders are not acceptable," Whip said, after Palauan police, in conjunction with the U.S. Coast Guard, seized a Chinese vessel for illegally harvesting sea cucumber in Palauan waters in December 2020. Quote from the president here, quote, "Stealing and offering bribes, that's just got to stop. Illegal fishing has got to stop. As countries, we should be responsible to our people and tell them not to go to other countries and do these kinds of things," unquote. So that's the president of Palau, and there are issues, I'm sure, that he sees up close and personal that the Chinese are doing in his waters of the Pacific. Talk a little bit about the president of Palau and what role he can play here with his peers and neighbors.
Absolutely. Well, he's an exceptional leader, and he's shown himself in a short period in office to be a leader among the Pacific Islands. But before we go into too much about President Whips, I think this helps frame why he's a leader, and in addition to One Belt, One Road and some of the things I mentioned with infrastructure and indebtedness and some of that behavior, one of the things that has galvanized him, galvanized a lot of the Pacific population and some of the leadership to having a real China skepticism, is the illegal fishing. And I think you can understand the backlash that I think is beginning to grow in the Pacific towards Beijing without understanding, one, how vital fishing and fisheries are to the people of the Pacific. It's cultural. It's where a lot of the culture of Melanesia and Polynesia and Micronesia stems, and the folklore and the traditions stem from the sea and from their tradition of seafaring. And remember, most of these islands were populated by people who came from other islands by sea. And so it's a tremendously important part of their national and cultural lore and identity. And then economically, most of these islands, not all, but many, or if not most of these islands, derive a significant or majority share of their economic output from fishing. And so what you have, this Chinese international fishing fleet, which we've seen militarized in different parts of the world, most recently in the South China Sea, but this fishing fleet goes around the Pacific catching vast troves of tuna and other fish stocks without following best practices, without any regard for overfishing or kind of the type of sustainable fishing that most countries and most economies have adopted in the 21st century, and then in total violation in many, many instances of international law and the respect for sovereignty, respect for territorial waters. So you'll have these vast fishing fleets come into places like Palau, like Samoa, like American Samoa. They'll come into places like the Marshall Islands, and they'll illegally fish in vast, vast numbers. And these countries are not equipped. They don't have militaries for the most part. If they have a police force, it's small. And they'll come in. They'll be outgunned by the Chinese fishing fleet. You often see violent confrontations. And the Chinese will take huge – I mean, you'll see these pictures of the Chinese taking thousands of sharks, which are incredibly valuable both for the ecosystem and economically. They'll take – thousands, a single catch of thousands of sharks. They'll cut off the fins, throw the shark carcasses in the water, and just take the shark fins back to China where they're a delicacy. And it's that type of behavior that has gotten people like President Whips, it's led to them speaking out, and it's something that's often referred to as the Pacific Way. You know, it's a way of approaching diplomacy and approaching politics. It's very soft-spoken. It's very, confrontation-averse. It's very much focused on finding solutions quietly without public confrontation. What we've seen with someone like President Whips, and to a lesser extent President David Kabua in the Marshall Islands, someone like President Lionel Ngamea in Nauru, they've come to the conclusion now that China has become so egregious in its behavior, so egregious in its meddling in the internal affairs of other countries, in the illegal fishing, in One Belt, One Road, that they can't stay silent. They can't follow the Pacific Way approach all the time anymore. And this has led to, President Whips, I think, laying down a marker and saying, this new generation of Pacific leaders see the United States as not just one of multiple partners in the Pacific, but they see the United States and Australia and New Zealand as the partner of choice, and they see China as a tremendous challenge. And so that's where I think we have this great opportunity with new leaders like President Whips for the United States to build much more significant and robust relationships to directly take on the China challenge. And this is really a unique opportunity, which frankly has been brought on in the last couple of years by China's behavior.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the Coast Guard, because you had a commentary in the Wall Street Journal back in April about sending in the Coast Guard to counter Beijing, which sent me off, of course, on a great riff of because you talked about the gray little green men kind of concept. China uses these gray area concepts. This is just an innocent fishing fleet. Of course, it's got 500 ships in it. We're just stripping the oceans. I started thinking, our Coast Guard is too small. And you note that in that Wall Street Journal piece. And I started thinking, well, we've got all these LCSs, which aren't really much good for a lot of stuff. But if we put an orange stripe on them and send them out to the Marshalls or the Carolines or out in the Palauan waters, might that not help control some of this behavior?
Yeah, look, I think it's you know, to me, it's less of a platform issue. I mean, I think an LCS is definitely an option. I think, you know, in an ideal world, we would have more national security cutters to be able to do more of this. But I think there are offshore patrol cutters. There are all sorts of different platforms that could do this work. I mean, I've seen some impressive smaller ships that the Coast Guard's put into action that have gone up against some of the Chinese fishing fleet and have been incredibly useful. I think to me, it's more of a question of how do we deal with this fallacy that the Chinese have introduced that they've got essentially the PLA in, but painted different colors, operating in an incredibly provocative and militant manner. But because of the way they've painted the ships and they advertised the ships, it's created this environment where we are in the position of escalating if we go in with the type of firepower that we currently have available in the region. So to me, it's really a question of, you know, less of platform and more of, you know, the Coast Guard has this unique position as a quasi-military, quasi-law enforcement, and because it fills that role, when it goes into a situation like this, it's not inherently escalatory when they confront these Chinese, you know, little green men, little blue men, whatever you want to call them. And so that's where I think, you know, these guys have it's a $12 billion budget. The Coast Guard is dramatically under-resourced for what we ask them to do as a country. I think if we, you know, find a way to get them additional resources, whether that's LCS with a different controlling owner, whether that's additional national security cutters, whether that's offshore patrol cutters, whatever that platform might be, I think it's their unique nature as a quasi-military, quasi-law enforcement service that makes them so potentially useful as the Chinese continue to play this hybrid warfare ambiguous card in the Pacific. I think Coast Guard can really be an effective tool there.
Somebody has got to crack the code on how to confront the Chinese fishing fleet. I have a friend of mine runs a seafood wholesaler, and he's very familiar with these fleets. And I was talking to him about them, and he said they, amongst many things, they are pretty much cities afloat. They have their own bars, their own brothels. They bring everything with them, and they go to sea for a long time. And it's one thing to have one or two fishing boats. It's another thing to have 200 to 500. And we've recently seen the Chinese massive fleet off the Galapagos last year. I believe right now they're off Argentina and Uruguay, which is interesting because I think a couple of years ago the Argentines actually sank a Chinese fishing boat. When you look at these large fleets, how much of it is similar economically to what we saw with the old Soviet strip mining of the sea in the last couple of decades of their existence with their factory ships, and how much of it is a PSYOPs and InfoOps Greater China operation to see how much they can intimidate some of these coastal nations?
So I think one of the biggest intelligence challenges that we have right now, at least in the Pacific, is understanding the command and control structure of these fishing fleets. You know, the Chinese have built this overlapping apparatus of maritime-related entities, you know, the State Oceanic Administration, the Coast Guard, the obviously the PLAN, and then you have the maritime militia, and then you have the supposedly commercial fishing fleet. Really understanding how those all play out, how they're interconnected, I think to focus particularly on the ostensibly commercial fishing fleet, how do they receive orders? How do they make their decisions about where to fish and when to fish and how to fish? I think that's all very much worthy of further analysis. I think that, you know, the comparison is interesting between what the Soviets did in the 80s and up to the collapse and what the Chinese are doing now. The only difference that I see, the main difference I see is that the Soviets seemed to be kind of behaving. It actually could have, probably should have been a sign that they were in their death throes, because they showed absolutely no interest in any sort of best practices or behavior, and it was totally ecologically damaging, and it was just, you know, whatever went to extract as much as possible as quickly as possible. The Chinese are doing the same thing, but there's a political element to it that I don't, in my reading of what the Soviets did, I don't see as much. The Chinese are certainly, you know, the equivalent of strip mining the world's fisheries. But what they're also doing is they're doing it in strategic locations. They're showing up like they did in Philippine waters in recent months, you know, at times of particular tension. So they're clearly ostensibly, you know, commercial, but they have a larger political purpose that I think we need to understand better, how that fits into decision-making within the CCP and the Chinese government more broadly. And that's an area where I think we're deficient in our understanding, and where a better understanding of how these fishing fleets have been weaponized and how those decisions are made could help us more accurately, not just, I don't think we're ever going to deter them, but respond to them in an effective manner. I mean, I remember I was in government during the Galapagos incident, and, you know, the Ecuadorians were just completely overwhelmed by the several hundred ships that were showing up in the Galapagos waters, and there was nothing that the Ecuadorian Coast Guard could do to counter it. And so I think one of the things we have to start thinking about is, you know, countries that have had significant run-ins with these Chinese fishing fleets, which, as I mentioned earlier, they get violent. They're not just taking, extracting fish and doing it in an ecologically damaging way and leaving. They're oftentimes getting into violent confrontations with other fishermen, but also with Coast Guards and even navies from host governments. So I think we need to start thinking about, one, you know, how can we provide training and capability enhancement for countries that are in the target of the Chinese in this front? One of the things that the Coast Guard has that's been incredibly helpful is the Coast Guard does shipwrighter agreements, where they'll go around, they do it in the Pacific, but they do it elsewhere as well. They'll go and they'll have a Coast Guard officer who's been specially trained come on board a local ship, and vice versa. They'll also have a local officer come on board a Coast Guard ship, which is probably the most effective way of doing it. They'll go around, let's say, in Tuvalu or the Solomon Islands. They'll go around, and what you ultimately have is U.S. Coast Guard platform capability matched with a local officer who can have law enforcement powers. And so you'll be able to deal with a lot of the illegal fishing in a much more effective way, because you've got U.S. capabilities and local law enforcement working together. So I think that's an area where we could do a lot going forward, and we could enhance that capability, particularly in the Pacific.
Yeah, I want to cycle back to what you talked about with these compacts of free association. You know, I'm looking at the countries that surround Oceania. I mean, it's the U.S., it's Japan, it's France, it's Australia, it's New Zealand, and the, I mean, the U.K., obviously, through the Commonwealth to that extent. Is there the possibility of some international organization, I don't want to use the NATO exactly, but a larger compact that would take all these countries and say, look, we've all got an investment in this area. It's all important to all of us. Can we, and I know the Australians and New Zealanders are pretty active in some of those islands, but can we move forward with some larger scheme to get more people involved in resisting this Chinese assault?
Yeah, you know, I'm usually wary of giant, you know, multilateral efforts on this front. It gets unwieldy. People have different interests, different histories, different relationships with the islanders. I think one of the ways, you know, now that being said, you know, one of the things I'm going to write an article about this soon. You know, for a long time, the U.S., Australia, and New Zealand essentially said, we're going to divide up the Pacific. The Americans will worry about Micronesia. The Australians will worry about Melanesia. The Kiwis will worry about Polynesia. And we'll all kind of in each other, you know, stay out of each other's way and focus on our little subregions. And I think what's been revealed recently because of Chinese activity is it does take the larger kind of push you're talking about. It does take a combined effort to operate in a great power competition that's this intense and this multi-domain and has this many components to it. But what I think is more effective than some giant, you know, group of you know, like a CETO or a NATO or something like that, which I think is going to get bogged down pretty quickly, I think what would be useful is to have kind of ad hoc groups of countries that are similarly aligned and have similar capabilities and interests in a particular country working together. So, for instance, in the four countries where Taiwan has recognition, Taiwan does extraordinary work on infrastructure, on health, on education, public sanitation, and is a huge force multiplier for the United States, even in places like the Marshall Islands and Palau, where we have the compacts. Japan, you know, Japan has obviously a very difficult history with a lot of these islands, but it's done over 75 years. It's done an extraordinary job overcoming it. And you see Japan is seen by many of these countries as a pretty significant and respected partner. So I think there are definitely places where the U.S. working with kind of a coalition of the willing can be effective. And that's what I'd like to see. I'd like to see, you know, one of the things we pushed in the last administration, and I believe is being continued in the current administration, is much more intelligence sharing and coordination, you know, regularly getting together and all the Pacific watchers in Australia, New Zealand, the U.S., Japan, Great Britain now, France, which has a lot of interest in the Pacific, hopefully more Taiwan, will all meet on a more regular basis and kind of figure out, okay, how do we divide our time and our labor and our resources to deal with the challenges that we're facing in a different Pacific island?
And it appears that your call for, you know, ad hoc gatherings might be one of the few options we have right now, because you raised in your article back in February about an existing organization, which was called the Pacific Islands Forum, that the Micronesian states just left from what looks like, I don't know, political patronage or political power plays or my buddy over your buddy situation. But they left an organization that was important to that region. Has anything changed since your February article, and do you still see that event today as big of a potential issue that you did back in February?
Well, I think it's important. The organization was important because the PIF, as it's called, is important because it was a forum for the region to amplify a voice that's otherwise a relatively small one on the world stage. Small countries, relatively undeveloped countries, and this is their platform to speak a little more loudly. What's become increasingly clear as the months have gone on is that, you know, the ostensible reason for the departure of the Micronesian states was a personnel issue. Who was going to be Secretary General of the Pacific Islands Forum? Would it be the Marshall Islanders, who felt that that they, representing the subregion of Micronesia, deserve to have their turn? That was ostensibly the reason for the departure. I think there were much deeper issues at play, and one of those issues was China and a feeling among the Micronesians, who have been the most, I think, victimized by China and the most politically willing to stand up and speak out about some of the coercion and some of the bad practices, feeling that the South Pacific, the Samoas, the Vanuatus, and others didn't have the same appreciation for the challenge and the threat and weren't willing to speak out as clearly and as forthrightly about it. And so, you know, I stand by my position that we need to have a reconciliation. Ultimately, the forum is valuable. It needs to come back together. There needs to be some sort of political compromise that allows the Micronesians to come back in a way that that works for them. On the other hand, I think that the Micronesians are, and President Whips of Palau, who we talked about earlier, I think he's the best example of this. The Micronesians are beginning to say, look, you know, there definitely are valuable reasons for us to be in the PIF and to talk, you know, about it, try and get back in the PIF and to have conversations on things where we agree. But there, the big issue in the region, China, its role, its ambitions, that may have to be something that we do outside of the PIF. You know, that there may just be, we may be at a point where we can't reconcile all of the different subregions, all the different countries. Some people have just chosen to take a much different position on China than others. And folks like Palau and the Marshall Islands and Micronesia and Nauru and Tuvalu may have to build either, you know, stronger subregional groupings with themselves, or they may just have to strengthen their bilateral relationships with the U.S. and Australia and New Zealand and Japan and Taiwan. And, you know, I think ultimately it might not be mutually exclusive to have a PIF that encompasses the region, that talks about some issues, environment, among others, but that on the big pressing, you know, issue of China may not speak as one voice. And there just may have to be other forums where that's discussed by people who share a common view.
Yeah, I think it's really important, too, I think, in what you just said, that to recognize that even though all these people are Pacific Islanders, they aren't necessarily all exactly the same. They all have different interests, different cultural backgrounds, and different histories, and that has to be dealt with. We, you know, it is not one of those things where one size fits all. But as I say that, you've been really kind to be with us for an hour of your time. And before we let you go, tell us what you're working on, what we can look forward to, and when we can look forward to seeing it. Will you, Alex?
Well, I'm actually doing a book on the history of U.S. strategy in the Pacific Islands. I think it's a topic that we really haven't heard enough from the kind of the American perspective. The Australians, the New Zealanders talk about it a lot. We kind of, there's a body of scholarship on how they've interacted with the region since their West colonization. We really haven't done that in the United States. So I'm hoping to make a contribution to that, hopefully have that done next summer. And also hopefully can talk to you guys at some point about Antarctica and Chinese ambitions in Antarctica, which is another understudied, underappreciated area, but where I think we're going to start seeing a lot more PLA activity and a lot more potentially, just like we've seen in the Arctic, a lot more manifested Chinese ambitions.
Well, Alex, this has been a great hour, and I read something, you know, you mentioned Antarctica, a couple of articles recently about recognizing another ocean down there. So, yeah, whether it's the Antarctic or the Arctic, one of the two, that the Chinese are playing around there more. So I'll be keeping an eye open for that from you. And as Mark said, thank you very much for joining us today. I thoroughly enjoyed it and look forward to the opportunity to talk to you again.
Thank you both. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, you can come back again when you're ready to talk about Antarctica. We'll be glad to have you.
Great. Look forward to it.
And thank you, everyone, for joining us for another edition of Midrat. Have a great day. Cheers.